Good evening. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very happy to be here. And this is a continuation of a step series. And tonight we're on step six. It's really one of my favorite steps. This is step seven. Fortunately or unfortunately, I'm sort of waxing serious tonight. I drove up with Paul, a wonderful guy, good friend of mine, he works with sort of like a two-hatter, you know what I mean? He's in AA, but he sort of works with alcoholics and things like that, and he was telling me I did a talk at the, where was I the other night? I was at the Phoenix Group, I guess, at South Miami Hospital, where they bring in all the new people, you know, guys in detox and stuff like that. So they asked me to speak there, so I did a talk, and I think he told me he was handling a group after that, and they were all depressed and suicidal. So they had to bring somebody in after the talk to sort of prop them up. You know what I mean? Well, I said I'm like it's like good cop, bad cop. I'm the bad cop. You know, you need the bad cop, and that's it. So I'm here to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. So I'm going to tell you the bad news and the good news, or the good news and the bad news, or maybe it's just all bad news. I think it's good news. You know, when I was in law school, they said, look to your right and look to your left. You know, one of those guys ain't going to be here, or two of those guys ain't going to be here. And you know something? It sort of scared me, but I never worried about it because I knew I was going to be the one that was there. You see, you never have to worry about statistics. You know, statistically, the statistics I've heard, as far as AA is concerned, is that 0.5% stay sober for more than 20 years. It's like 1 in 200. I don't know who does statistics. I don't know if it's true, false, whatever. But after being around here for a long period of time, having had a drink in 31 years, I pretty much believe that that's pretty much the case. I mean, I've seen him drink at 5 years, at 10 years, at 15 years. We were talking about somebody tonight. I met, there were three guys sitting at the table tonight. One guy drank at 17 years. One guy drank at 12 years. One guy drank at 7 years. And it's not that you can't come back or something like this. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, it's just... Finding people with 20, 30, 40 years is like rare as hen's teeth around here. And A's been around for like 75 years. Been around for a long time. And even if you go to any of these rooms, like if you go into my room, the call room, what they do is they have all the birthdays. I don't know how they do it in your room. They have all the birthdays lumped up into like a little thing on the board. It's a chart on the board. Thank you. And they'll have like 20 or 30 names. This one has 1 year, and this one has 2 years, and this one has... 5 years, and this one has 10 years, and this one has 15 years, and it looks like everybody's staying sober. And what I believe, I mean, if I was to run the world, boy, we'd all be in trouble, but if I was to do it, because, well, you know, they say the truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off, and it says the truth, you can't handle the truth, and I believe we have to live in truth. And part of living in truth is not playing make-believe, you know what I mean? Understanding what we're really dealing with, because if people... Maybe it's scary, maybe it's depressing, but if more people were scared and depressed, you know what I mean, or concerned, maybe things would be a little different around here. You know, I mean, there is something to be said to being 63 years old, which is what I am. I think differently about life now. I think just the idea of being 63 years of age and not thinking, and knowing that I ain't going to live forever, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing to be diagnosed with cancer a couple of times. It really isn't. It's actually one of the best things that ever happened to me. You know, I guess when you're 19, 20, 30 years old, maybe even 40 years old, I've met 70-year-olds that think they're going to live forever. They act like 15-year-olds. There's something, nothing that gets you more serious than realize that eternity is right around the corner. And it really gets you growing up, you know, because we're going to talk about men and boys here. You know, this is about separating men and boys, so I guess women from girls or something. It's about taking things serious. It's about getting serious. It's not about AA toga parties. Or when we're going to have the next AA costume party, or the next drunk log or banquet when we can all get together and yuck it up, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not going to say there's something wrong with that. It's about getting serious. Not that it's like an AA party, you know what I mean? You know, and oh man, I don't want to listen to that guy. It's like brings me down, you know. It's like an AA party to understand what's really going on here. So that's what I'm going to talk about, because now we're like getting serious. Now we're not teenagers, and now we're getting serious. And this is the step that separates the men from the boys, which means that apparently... Now, here's what I'm doing. Now, go along with me on this. Forget about my opinion. Forget about me or my personality. It's not personality. This is all about the literature. Let's assume, like I assume, that no matter what I think, You know, my best thinking got me in here. Alcoholics, extreme example, self will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. I mean, let's say I take my thinking and I throw it in the garbage can because it didn't really serve me too well. And I decide that I'm going to believe everything in this book. Now, somewhere in this book, it says this is the step that separates the man from the boy, which means that there must be a separation in AA between the men and the boys, or the girls and the women. There must be something in AA where something happens along the way where one group somehow keeps on moving forward and another group sort of stays somewhere around 3 years sobriety, even if they have 20 years. They just never really quite grow up. You ever meet people that never really quite grow up? I mean, they may be 40, 50, 60 years old, but they're just still a thumb-sucking crybaby. They're still just crying. They're still acting, talking, and thinking about the things that, you know, really a 20-year-old should be thinking about. Or a 22, but they're 70. You know what I mean? It's sort of like it doesn't fit. You know, it's easy to live in a delusional dream world because we're selfish and self-centered in here. You know, it's easy for alcoholics to do that. And you know, we really don't want to hear about serious stuff, you know what I mean? Because somebody starts talking serious, that's not fun. That's not a happy thing. You know, I mean, this guy, man, you know something, that guy's like a downer. You know, well, I'll tell you something. If you accept what life on life's term and what's really going on, it's not really not a downer, it's the greatest thing in the world. It's only a downer if you want to play child for the rest of your life. Then it becomes like a downer, I suppose. You know, but if you accept, you know, the facts of life, it's not a downer anymore. So I want to read you a couple of things from the books. And I want to talk to you about the American Revolution. Because I think if you understand the American Revolution, you're really going to get this six-step deal. Okay? Listen, I try to feed this stuff to you, you know, in such a way so that you'll maybe remember it. Maybe you won't remember it. You know, A is like a giant toolbox. There's a wrench to fit every nut that walks through the door. And, you know, I don't know what it is. You know, as I grow older and I start connecting dots and seeing things differently, I just sort of things just pop in my mind, and I go with the Spirit. I go with the Holy Spirit, wherever the Spirit leads me. I don't try to dissect these things. If something comes up and I'm going to do this thing and I start thinking about something, you know, I just say, why am I thinking about this thing when I'm talking about the sixth step? And how can I, what is that, what's the deal there? And I learned stuff. I learned a lot of stuff about this deal, and I just started thinking about Thomas Paine. You know, he wrote a book called Common Sense. Common Sense was a book that was written in like 1776 about the American Revolution when we were breaking away. The Declaration of Independence, the Declaration of Freedom from England. And what Common Sense really was is there was a compendium of essays that he wrote about independence from freedom, independence from slavery, from being enslaved by another people. And there were about 7 or 10 of these essays, and they put it together in one book, and they called it Common Sense. And so I want to read you a little something from that book, just a little small excerpt from that book, and I want to talk to you about Valley Forge a little bit. And then I want to talk to you about the sixth step. And, you know, I could be all wet here, but we'll see whether any of this stuff fits in, okay? And if you don't get anything, you'll learn a little bit about American history. You'll be able to say, so what happened to Russell? When you say, oh, we didn't learn anything about the sixth step, but let me tell you about Valley Forge, you know what I mean? So, you know, let me, Valley Forge. So we're going to learn a little bit about Valley Forge, the American Revolution, and Sermon on the Mount, and something about the big book and the 12 and 12. Okay, so Dr. Bob on Dr. Bob in the Good Old Times. Dr. Bob noting that there were no 12 steps at the time and that our stories didn't amount to anything to speak of, later said they were convinced that the answer to their problems were in the good book, the Bible. To some of us older ones, the parts that we found absolutely essential were the Sermon on the Mount, the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, and the book of James. So the essential books, absolutely essential, they found were the Sermon on the Mount, 1 Corinthians 13, and the book of James. I am going to talk a little bit about parts of the Sermon on the Mount, which is really on chapter 6, and how it fits into this deal, because that's all they were reading back then. As a matter of fact, in another part of the, before, you know, you understand that A was founded in 1935, the big book was written in 1939, so between 1935 and 1939, they never read the big book, they never read the 12 and 12, they never read any of that stuff. Because it hadn't been printed. So when you hear at every meeting, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. They're talking about following the path that we followed, which had nothing to do with reading the big book of the 12 and 12. So somewhere when you get to the point where you become a man instead of a boy, and you're not so scared of crap, or a woman instead of a girl, you might ask the question, well, what the hell were they reading? What the hell were they reading? And maybe you'll actually get into Alcoholics Anonymous, which says we lose all prejudice even against organized religion. They say that in AA. Now, I know in AA fellowship, they say, I don't want to hear that stuff. I'm spiritual, not religious. But, of course, that's not AA. That's just some guy who's suffering from alcoholism who's still pissed off. So if you want that, if that's the sobriety you want, it's available to you in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the one thing I learned about this group is it ain't Well People's Anonymous. And if you haven't learned that this ain't Well People's Anonymous, you haven't gone to enough discussion meetings. You need to go to a few more, okay? Then you'll find out what the deal is all about. So in any event, let's get to it, okay? When I was, I've done a lot of things in my life. I'm 63, I'm a lawyer, and done a lot of stuff, and I guess some good stuff, and relatively, you know, what is it, relatively successful, I don't know, in some things. And, you know, one time I picked up, I think last week or the week before, I was sharing about the girl thing. I think I now realize, looking back, that, you know, before the age of like 40 or 50, I don't know what it was, or 35, I think I was motivated a lot of times by women, you know, and stuff like that. And, you know, I remembered one time when I took up the guitar. Now I'm 63. I don't know how many people are 63 or something like that. But, you know, I when I was growing up, it was like the Beatles, you know, and all that sort of stuff, and the Beach Boys and all that sort of deal. So I remember taking up the guitar. And the truth is, my motivation for taking up the guitar is that I was convinced in my delusional mind that I was going to be the next Donovan or, you know, or Dion or whatever it is, you know, the next, you know, Beatle or whatever it is. And, you know, I was going to be able to learn to play guitar and sing and girls would like me. You understand what I'm saying? Okay. You know, so the bottom line, and I, you know, became fairly good at playing the guitar. But, you know, somewhere, and I would practice playing the guitar, and I sort of like playing the guitar, and I like the music and everything like that, but, you know, the primary motivation was the woman thing, you know? Yeah, but you want to know something? Although that was my primary motivation, and I'm just talking about myself, I'm not talking about anybody else in here, I never became real, real good at the guitar because I just was never willing to put on in the effort that it took to be, like, perfect, to be, like, you know, Carnegie Hall, to be like the perfect, you know, like an Olympic, to be real good. I was only willing to put in the sort of like effort it took to be like, well, I guess what it's described, and I don't have the definition there, is what we call a dilettante. A dilettante, the definition, as I remember, of a dilettante, you know, I guess it's sort of like a French word, is somebody who like dabbles in shit. You know, I was like a dabble, you know, like today it's the guitar, tomorrow it's judo. You know what I mean? Today it's this, tomorrow it's that. And I would always do it good enough so it would be okay, but I was never willing to really stretch. I was never really to be the Olympian, you know what I mean? I'd never make it like to the finals or the semifinals, you know, maybe like just getting into the first tier or the second tier or something like that. I was never really willing to go for the gold in anything. And, you know, the interesting thing is how far you can get in this world, and I'm not saying being mediocre, because I've accomplished a lot of things that people, you know, I was a National Science Foundation fellow, you know, I got a lot of degrees, and I'd be a law scholar, and that's accomplishing something. But the truth is, even, you know, that stuff, I don't want to say it came easy to me, but the truth of the matter is I never really killed myself. You know, I got to a certain point, and I got my deal, and I did this, and I did that, but it was never really a matter of being obsessed with being the best, you know, like the Army thing, the best that you could be, you know what I mean? Really going after the gold. It was always like I was like phoning in the paycheck. You know, I was just, you know, I was doing what I felt comfortable to me. And when I think about it, I'm trying to think, what was my motivation for even doing anything I did? It was like girls and things, and so, there was nothing really major about it. I don't remember any time in my life where I had like a major motivation outside of getting some more money or, you know, having sex or getting a gal or, I mean, I never had like a motivation of anything that you could be really like proud of, anything that was unselfish, you know what I mean? My motivation was always something, well, maybe I get a little, you know, a little something here, I get more money there, or maybe people look up to me, you know, or maybe, you know, I get a little bit more attention. Or I mean, when I think about my motivation for doing stuff, it was all selfish, self-centered, vanity, like they say in Ecclesiastes, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. It was all vain stuff, trying to gather up stuff so that I would feel better. I mean, when you think about it, it was so pitiful and pathetic. I almost hate to admit it. It's almost like, I really wasn't even a worthwhile human being. I mean, I did a couple of nice things. You know, I raised some great kids and everything like that. But I mean, nothing I could be really, I can honestly say that I did that was selfless and something that was really virtuous. Because when you scratch the surface, when it came right down to it, it was all about me. It was about me getting ahead and worrying about me and doing the best for me and me, 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 me. And, you know, I come, you know, you come to this deal, the first thing that you start learning is stupid stuff. Like, you got to start, whether you understand it or not, they have you helping others and doing crap and all that sort of stuff, none of the, which makes sense. But, you know, it's like you fake it until you make it, but eventually you got to make it. Now, while we're going through this whole exercise of the crap, I'm just talking about the way I was, I come upon this thing called the 12 and 12, you know, and it's also in the big book, where it talks about independence or freedom. There's a lot of talk in the big book about freedom, because that's what sobriety is really about. It's about freedom. It's about freedom from bondage. Not only bondage from alcohol, slavery to alcohol, it's freedom from bondage to yourself, bondage to money, bondage to things, bondage to anything, bondage to people, bondage to your own thoughts. It's about freedom. And they say stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. They just sort of say stuff, which you read, you know, sort of sounds good, but you don't really know what they're talking about. I mean, it's really interesting. You read this book, and it sort of sounds really good, sounds, you know, like poetry, but it's not like you really analyze it. You know, like they say something like this, and this is in the book, so I guess it must be true. Or if it's not true, at least it's AA. It's AA. This is AA. We're supposed to be talking about AA here. So whether you believe it or not, whether it's true or not, whether you understand, it's AA. This is my opinion, and this is what it says in step three. The more we become willing to depend upon a higher power, depend upon God, the more independent we actually are. Therefore, dependence upon God and the AA practices is really a means of great gaining true independence of the spirit. In other words, we worry about being dependent upon anybody. You know what I mean? I don't want to be dependent upon it. But the truth is, alcoholics are totally dependent upon everything. I mean, our feelings get hurt really easily. The way we are, how we feel and what we think about ourselves depends upon how much weight we have, you know, what color our hair is, what others think about us, how much money we have in the bank. We are the most dependent people in the world. If you scratch us over here, something happens over there. I was an if-onlier and a yes-butter. If only this, if only that, if only he didn't do this, if only they didn't do that, if I only had this. If you didn't do this, I wouldn't do it. I mean, my whole life and how I feel myself depends upon 18,000 different things being exactly right the certain way. You know what I mean? And the bottom line is it's going to be okay as long as I get this or as long as I move to this, and it's never okay. You know, there's got to be certain conditions. I mean, I'm the most dependent person in the world, and this thing tells me true dependence depends upon my total dependence upon God, which is a difficult thing if that's true because I don't believe in God. I don't even know what they're talking about when they say God. Because I'm spiritual, not religious. You know, or whatever that means. I don't even know what that means. You know what I mean? So you got this book that's talking about stuff, and I don't even know what they're talking about, because all I know about is give me a scotch. I mean, I never talk about this stuff in the bars. They're using language and statements that I've never even thought about. True independence upon God, I don't even know whether I want to believe in God. I don't even know who God is. And in order to be free, I got to have true dependence upon him who I don't know who he is. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others, and that's how I'll be free. And apparently this freedom is important because in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, they say a lot of things about that. It says right here, this is the how and why of it. This is around step three. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided hereinafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father. We are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. To freedom. You know what it says in the vision for you? It says here, once in a while, a person being dry at the moment says, I feel better, look better, have a better time. You know, I don't miss drinking. We laugh at that such salad. We know he's going to try the old game again, because he's not happy with his sobriety. Soon he'll know terror, as few people know, and loneliness, as so few people do. You know why? Because he's not happy with his sobriety, because he's not free. Because he's not free, because he's not drinking, but he's still drinking people. He's still drinking people. He's still thinking about people. He's got people on his mind. He's got money on his mind. He's got things on his mind. He's got stuff on his mind that he's so bound up in other stuff and other things. He can never know true freedom because he only knows it's 3 o'clock in the morning. He can't get any sleep because his mind is ganging up on him. And he hasn't had a drink in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, but he's a thumb-sucking crybaby, and he's not free, and he's angry, and he's mad at himself and everybody else, and he can't have a true relationship with anybody because he's a basket case. And he's got 10 years. And he's got 15 years. And he's got 20 years. And they're all over the place here. They are because I sponsor them. I know them. They're around. Trust me. They're here. I'm not kidding. They're here. And they think they got something lit because they haven't had a drink. Now, it's good not to have a drink, but it's even better to not have a thing. It's even better to be free of the other stuff, of the alcoholism, which centers in your mind and not your body. Because the booze is really just a symptom. So to get rid of a symptom and still have the disease in full force, what's the point of that? So it says, then it says again, it says, we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. Him, who is he again? Here he is again. He's the guy who's going to give us true independence. What does this have to do with the sixth step? We're coming up on that. Now here we got right here, it says into action. Now we're on step 5. Having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude and a new relationship with our Creator and discover the obstacles to our path, the obstacles to that new relationship with our Creator, which if you look at step 11 is the bottom line thing. That's the bottom line thing. The bottom line thing is to have a relationship with your Creator, a spiritual relationship with your Creator. Oh, there's no steps here. Whatever. I'm pointing to something that's not existent. Well, you get the picture, you know? And then improve that relationship. Because somehow, if in fact it's true what they say in the book, and we judge that to be true, that true independence, true freedom depends upon your relationship with God, then you want to get as close to a perfect relationship with him, because therein the power comes in to change you into another human being. And so that's the deal. It says here, let's see. It says here, after the fifth step. Now this is after the fifth step. Right before the sixth step. It says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. That's not me. That's the big book. It's got to be tough if you're an atheist to do that, right? I'm not putting any, you know something? The only requirement... For membership is a desire to stop drinking. There's not a requirement that you have to be a believer. Now, there may be another requirement for emotional sobriety. There may be another, you know, there's another fellowship in here. They call it the Fellowship of the Spirit. It's talked about in the Visions for You. It says, we'll surely see in the Fellowship of the Spirit. There's another fellowship in here. It's called the Fellowship of the Spirit. Don't make the mistake of believing that everybody that is an Alcoholics Anonymous and is a member here is in the Fellowship of the Spirit. I mean, it's like, you know, just because you're standing in the garage doesn't mean you're a Chevy. You know, there are men and there are boys. There's a separation going on in here. You know, and if you don't believe it, there are people that drink after 5, 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, it happens. We thank God from the bottom of our heart we know him better. Taking this book down from the shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything for a building, if we have omitted anything, like making believe we're doing the third step when we're not really doing the third step, when we're hanging on to old ideas because we're prejudiced and we don't want to do this third step, like we're willfully not doing the third step and we say we are because it's my program and I'm changing the program, are we really doing the third step? Are we really utterly turning our lives utterly over to him? Or are we doing what alcoholics basically do? Are we doing what I did when I went to play my guitar, being dilettantes and dabbling but not going the whole way? Is that what we're doing? Is that what we're doing? Are we doing this the way I played my... You know what they say? Half measures availed us nothing. Are we really doing this exactly the way they did it? Rarely have I seen a person fail as thoroughly followed our path? Or are we doing this, you know, like with one hand behind their back with our fingers crossed, saying, I'm going to change the wording? You know, there's consequences to everything. Nobody gets away with anything in here. And that's why it says here, we thank God for the... Hey, listen, you think I'm tough. You don't want to hang around, you know, Dr. Bob. If you're an atheist, agnostic, or of any other form of intellectual pride that keeps you from understanding and accepting these things in this book, I feel sorry for you. Your heavenly father will never let you down. He was pretty strong on this deal. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. Taking the book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, We ask if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch. You ready for this? Where have you heard this before? Through which we shall walk a free man at last. The arch to freedom. Freedom from self. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? I mean, do you really want to live the rest of your life until you die worrying about whether or not you can come up here and speak, because what do they think about you? You really want to live the rest of your life worrying about what other people think about you? Would that come? I mean, that's a rough deal. They're not even thinking about you anyway. I mean, you want to really live the rest of your life saying, well, who's going to be there? If he's there, I'm not going. Having your actions and where you are dictated by who's there and who's not there. I mean, that's really, is that the way men and women live their lives? Worrying about other people and other women and all that stuff all the time, having that crap going on in their minds? You don't think that's part and parcel of alcoholism and codependency and being in bondage to all sorts of things that you don't even understand? And just because you got a 10-year chip in your pocket, you think you're okay? You know, because you have a birthday party and they all clap, you think you're okay, and then you walk away feeling crappy about yourself and your life? Is that what you want? Is that really what you're shooting for? That's what 15, 20 years of sobriety is for you? That's what you want out of this thing? Just to live a life of quiet, what is it? Life of quiet desperation. You know, I mean, just because you're not drinking doesn't mean you're not depressed or feeling lonely or all that sort of stuff that we talk about. No one. Is everybody welcome into Alcoholics Anonymous? Is everybody welcome into Alcoholics Anonymous? No, they're not. You guys really haven't read the book, have you? Yeah, well, that's the new AA thing. Be nice. Be nice. Make sure everybody likes you. Don't say anything to offend anybody. Don't hurt anybody's feelings. Laugh as they go into the grave and they die and they're doing crazy things, because you wouldn't want to hurt their feelings. Just be nice. Nice AA. Be nice, because that's what AA is about. Well, here's what it says. No one is too discredited or is sunk too low to be welcomed cordially if he means business. You see, back then, when Alcoholics Anonymous first started, there wasn't big rooms like this with like 100, 200 people in it, whatever it is. There wasn't this guy. There wasn't conventions. There were 3 or 4 or 10 people getting together. They didn't even know what they had. And it was the only thing that worked for them. And if it blew apart, you know what I mean? They were like dead. So like they were serious. So if they had some joker come in there who was trying to get laid or trying to do something else or thought it was a big deal, you know, they kicked his butt out of there. They said, why don't you go out and try some? They would say things like, why don't you try some controlled drinking? They didn't spend a whole long time arguing with people. Read Bill D. And when they went into the 12-step, they said to him, he says, we have this program. We think we can help people. Now, if you don't want this program, and if you think you can do it by yourself, we won't waste your time. We'll go looking for somebody who did. That was their attitude. We only want people that mean business and are serious about getting sober. They were reading the Bible. They were reading the Bible. They were putting people on their knees, you know, accepting God. You could come into the meeting. They were serious. They wanted people who were serious. They didn't want any people joking, smoking and joking and saying, well, this is no big deal to me. I'm not going to do any of this stuff. They didn't want any people arguing. Alcoholics are, now we're big. Now we're huge. Now we're a giant funnel. They come in here ready. They come in here not ready. If you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. We got people coming here. They want what we have. They're not willing to go to any length. We got people here that don't want anything we have. They just want what they got. It doesn't matter. I'm not looking to close it off. That we could have a giant funnel. But somewhere around the sixth step, maybe back then it was around the first step. But even in AA, somewhere around the sixth step, all them chickens start coming home to roost. Because it says right here, this is on the sixth step, right? It says this is the step that separates the men from the boys. It doesn't say the first step or the third. It says this is the step that separates the men from the boys. Whatever that means. So, let's get to the Revolutionary War. So I want to read you something. This is Thomas Paine wrote a series of articles in 1776 through 1778 called The Crisis. You might have heard about it. We were like in a deal thing with Great Britain. And he put it all together in a book called Common Sense. And I'm not going to, I want to read one part. It's actually the first paragraph of the first when he wrote in December 23rd, 1776. You've heard this before, okay? And this is what it says. He says, these are the times that try men's souls. He's talking about freedom. Remember the word freedom? These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will in this crisis shrink from the service of their country. Shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands by it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. You know, alcoholism isn't easily conquered either. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. It is dearness only that gives everything its value. Heaven knows how to put a proper price upon its goods, and it would be strange indeed if so celestial an article as freedom should not be highly rated. You know, when you talk about, they asked some people what they thought Thomas Paine meant by the summer soldier and the sunshine patriot. And here's some of the thoughts that came in. One of the thoughts said, the opening line was designed to remind the soldiers, many of whose enlistments were about to expire in January of 1777, that there was a difficult yet rewarding road ahead of them. The second person wrote down, it refers to someone who only wants to fight when it's warm and easy. And the third thing that was put down, and there were a lot of things, I just wrote down three, it means you are willing to fight when it's good, when your team is ahead, but you're gone when things get hard. But you're gone when things get tough. You know, that's, you know. Now, he wrote this, one of the things he was writing this about, and he would write things about, is about Valley Forge. I'm just going to read you a little snippet about Valley Forge. How many of you heard about this thing? It said, this was when they were all suffering, when the troops were really in bad shape. This is the winter of suffering. Well, imagine that you are in the army and you have very little bread or meat to eat. Your shoes are worn through, your clothes were made for warmer weather or well-worn from many battles, and you have no warm place to sleep. The Continental Army arrived at Valley Forge on December 19, 1777, after a tough campaign of battles with the British. Since early fall, General Washington had problems with getting supplies to his troops. As winter approached, the problems became worse. Soldiers received irregular supplies of meat and bread. Shortages forced men to forage for food in the forest and farm fields that they passed. Conditions were so severe that General Washington wrote that unless some great and capital change suddenly takes place, this army must inevitably starve, dissolve, or disperse in order to obtain sustenance in the best manner they can. Feeding the 12,000-plus men at the encampment was only one of the problems. Clothing, too, was a problem. Long marches had destroyed the men's shoes. These guys didn't even have shoes. Blankets were scarce. Tattered garments were seldom replaced. At one point, these shortages caused nearly 4,000 men to be listed as unfit for duty. Undernourished, poorly clothed, and living in a crowded, damp quarters, many soldiers became very sick. Typhus, typhoid, dysentery, and pneumonia killed as many as 2,000 men that had been sent from camp to hospital established in the surrounding countryside during the winter of 1777 and 1778. Although Washington repeatedly asked Congress for help, it was not available and the soldiers continued to suffer. Wives, sisters, and daughters of the enlisted men tried to ease the suffering by providing desperately needed services such as laundry and possible nursing care. And it says this, what Washington said was to see the men without clothes to cover their nakedness, without blankets to lie upon, without shoes, without a house or a hut to cover them until those could be built. And submitting without a murmur is a proof of patience and obedience, which in my opinion can scarcely be paralleled. This was George Washington at Valley Forge, April 21st, 1778. You know, would you complain? Have you ever been to discussion meetings? It's just one big complaint. You know, they took away my cell phone. My parents don't understand. According to General George Washington's letter to Congress, the soldiers at his Continental Army did not complain. So here's what it says in step six. It says, this is the step that separates the men from the boys. You know, I think. Why did I read that thing? Because I think that there's a direct parallel between what they were talking about, what Thomas Paine was talking about, and what I see happens in here between the 1 in 200, the 1 in 200 that knuckles down and gets serious about this stuff and stops being a dilettante, and the 199 that can remain thumb-sucking crybabies. Thus, just here for the banquets and the parties and the fun and games. And not really here for what this deal is all about. And, you know, it really doesn't concern me what you think, because I am absolutely certain that in any A group, there's always at least one. And that's the guy I'm speaking to anyway, because that's the only guy who's really going to be around in 5, 10, or 15 years, and then he'll be doing what I'm doing. He'll be doing what I'm doing, while the other people are saying, I don't want to hear that guy anymore, because that's the only, and I don't know which guy that is. I don't know who that is. There could be 10 of them in here, but that's the guy I'm here to talk to. That's what this message is all about. This is the step that separates the men from the boys, so declares a well-loved clergyman who happens to be one of A's greatest friends. I want you to pick up on some of these things you might not pick up on. So declares a well-loved clergyman who happens to be one of A's friends. Clergyman. You ever hear somebody stand up and say, well, I'm spiritual, not religious? These guys hung around, fed off of priests and preachers. They didn't stand up in groups and put down the Roman Catholic Church. They didn't put down the Protestant. They didn't put down synagogues or the Bible or anything like that. They fed off of that. They took out of that what they wanted. They fed off of that. That's why they say in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, we lose all prejudice, even against organized religion. We begin to see where these people are right. We stop with the prejudice. We become open-minded. Is that the AA you know today? Of course not. Of course not. Not even close. Not even close. The AA you know today looks down like we're superior. Puts down in jokes smugly, you know, at people that are involved in religion. That's not what they were about. He goes on to explain that any person capable of enough willingness and honesty to try repeatedly step six on all his faults. By the way, what is step six? We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. All your defects of character. All your sins. All your defects of character. All your sins. Perfection. Am I saying, well, look at me, I'm perfect? No, I'm so screwed up, it's unbelievable. I'm as screwed up as any of you guys, you know what I mean? I got the same screw. That's why I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Not because you're perfect, because you got the same crazy screw-ups as I have. But the point is, I'm interested in trying to do better. You know, I haven't just gotten to a point in my life and said, like with the guitar, saying, that's good enough. That's good enough. You know why? And I can only tell you this way. The only reason why I haven't gotten to that point is because I'm not after a girl. I don't know how to explain it. It's not a girl I'm after. I'm not after a girl. I'm not after a car. I'm not after more money. You know, I'm not after any of that stuff. I'm after only one thing. There's only one thing I'm after. The thing they talk about in here. And the only way you're ever going to be after that one thing and fall in love with that one thing and want that one thing, you know what I mean, is if you get involved with what they talk, what this thing is all about. And if you're not involved in it, you're just going to think I'm crazy. But if you do get involved in it, it's going to be a love affair that's going to last for a long period of time, and you're never going to stop until you get better and better and better, and you can be constantly going up and reading more material and going to more meetings, hanging around with rabbis and priests and preachers, maybe even reading the Bible. You can be doing whatever you can to get closer and closer, and because this is the motor that drives men into becoming more free in Alcoholics Anonymous by their relationship with God. This is the motor that does it. This is the engine. Because after you're sober for 10 years, if you don't have that relationship with God and you don't want to have it more and you're not thirsty for Him, there's no motivation to stay sober anymore. Except the laughs and chuckles. Except the bread and circuses. Except what was going on in Rome. The gladiators killing the Christians. Let's go to A and get a chuckle. Let's look at the girls. You know, let's talk, let's do this. Like, there's no real motivation. There's no, it's just like, and after a while, it just gets old. You stop going to meetings because there's nothing that's firing your, putting a fire in your belly, because it's just one more meeting, one more gal, one more guy, one more banquet, one more this. And after a while, it's just not enough. But when you have a love affair with God, and you have that relationship they have going, like these guys had going, like Bill Wilson said, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, and I keep talking about it and telling other people, like I'm addicted to this guy, I want more of this stuff, you don't stop ever. This is the step that, and the other thing that happens is once you understand this, all of a sudden, you understand what they're talking about. Quite frankly, then all of a sudden you understand, now that's what they're talking about. And it becomes less mysterious. So when you hear, this is the step that separates the men from the boys, so declares a well-loved clergyman who happens to be one of A's greatest friends. He goes on to explain that any person capable of enough willingness and honestly to try repeatedly to lose all his defects in character, on all his faults, without any reservations whatsoever, has indeed come a long way spiritually and is therefore entitled to be called a man who is sincerely trying to grow in the image and likeness of his Creator, with a capital C, grow in the image and likeness of God. You understand? That's what they're talking about. You know? I mean, they're talking about it. It becomes clear as to what they're talking about. No, they may not use the word God all the time. Sometimes they use higher power. Sometimes they use Creator. Sometimes they use Father of Light. But it's pretty clear what they're talking about. It's pretty clear what the deal is. So step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, is A's way of stating the best possible attitude one can take in order to make a beginning on this lifetime job. This does not mean that we expect all our character defects to be lifted out of us as the drive to drink was. A few of them may be, but with most of them, we shall have to be content with patient improvement. The words entirely ready underline the fact that we want to aim at the very best we know we can learn. Not like the way I did the guitar. Not like dilettantes. And then it says this, and you know, I want to sort of, it says, some people may conclude that they are indeed ready to have all such defects taken from them, but even these people, if they construct a list of still milder defects, will be obliged to admit that they prefer to hang on to some of them. Therefore, it seems plain that few of us can quickly or easily become ready to aim at spiritual and moral perfection. Spiritual and moral perfection. Aiming at spiritual and moral perfection. You know, if you're saying, well, that's wrong, I don't want to listen to that, Russell. He says I have to be perfect. No, I'm not saying that. The 12 and 12 is saying that. Our program is saying that the men aim at trying to be spiritually and morally perfect, even though they fail every single time. Even though, you know, it's like the Apostle Paul said, I forget the past, I stretch on for the crown. I keep on going forward and forward like a true Olympian. You know what I mean? I don't stop. Even though I fall down, I get up and I move forward again. I don't settle. Therefore, it seems plain that few of us can quickly or easily become ready to aim at spiritual and moral perfection. We want to settle for only as much perfection as will get us by in life, according, of course, to our various and sundry ideas of what will get us by. So the difference between the men and the boys is the difference between striving for a self-determined objective and for the perfect objective, which is of God. So the difference is, what are you looking for? What do you want? Do you want to just be good enough for your satisfaction? You see, what I did was I played to the guitar until I was satisfied. And I said, well, that's enough, and I threw away the guitar. I've done everything in my life until I was satisfied. And I said, okay, that's as good as I'm going to do with that. You know, I don't want to do it anymore. And then I threw it away. I live life the way every one of you lives life. I did what I had to do until I got tired of it, and then I got another job. I did what I did until I got tired of it, and then I got another wife, another husband. I did what I did until I got tired of it, and then I got another car. I did what I did until I thought I did enough, and then I got tired of it. I wasn't going to persevere. I got something else and wondered why I was always feeling crappy and why things weren't working out for me, because I got exactly what I deserved, because that's the kind of life I lived and that's the way I thought you lived life. And this is, you do it to the end and you persevere forever. It's not your objective, it's God's objective. So you say, what's God's objective? Isn't that what the whole thing is about? Doing His will? Praying the power? What is it? It says, the power of His will, knowing His will. And isn't that what we say in the Serenity Prayer? Knowing His will and the power to do that deal. Isn't that what it says? Isn't that what we're here for? Doesn't it say somewhere in the book that this is why we're doing this? To be a maximum service to God and other people, knowing His will. So you say, well, how do I know God's will? You know, that's a problem you're going to have. That's a problem you're going to have. I mean, we could sit down and we have a talk for about an hour as to what I do to try to know his will. And I'm not saying I know it all the time. But I'll tell you something. Sometimes it's not that easy. You got to do a lot of stuff. You got to hang around with a lot of people. You got to go searching for it. You know, I'll tell you what, you got to be thirsty for that deal. You know, there are books that have been written. You may not realize this, but besides Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 of 12, you'd be surprised at the books that have been written over thousands of years who were men who were just as smart or maybe smarter than you. From Moses on down, who their whole compass was, how can I become closer to God? There's tons of books, St. Thomas Aquinas, that are written by men all through the centuries. Wars have been fought. Things have happened. There are people. You may find it's hard to believe, but before Alcoholics Anonymous actually came along, there were millions of brilliant people that wrote books and studied God's mind and what does God want us to do. I mean, you can actually do that, unless you're sort of like a dilettante. Say, I don't want to get involved in that crap. When's the next AA party? You know what I mean? You can do that deal. You know what I mean? I'll tell you something. If you really want, I'll tell you one thing, though. I believe Dr. Bob is right. If you really want a relationship with him and you want to do this thing and you start hanging around, I'll tell you what. You hang around those people that are doing this deal, that are focused on this thing, they'll tell you where to go. They'll tell you what to read. You know, I was told the man or woman you'll be in 5 years will depend upon the people you hang out with and the books you read. You know, there are people moving on. Hey, there are people moving on. You know, you'll see people in this deal and they seem to be doing this a different way than anybody else is doing it. They're moving on. They must be doing something. They must be speaking to somebody. They must be doing things that maybe you're not doing. Going to meetings you're not meeting. Maybe doing some little extracurricular stuff or extra credit stuff. I know some of you aren't here. I know a lot of you guys aren't here for extra credit. Maybe there's some extra credit stuff you can do. Did you know in the book it says talks about joining a church or a synagogue? Did you know that it's a couple of places? You know they encourage that? Did you know they encourage that in AA? I know you wouldn't think that because you think, listen to the fellowship, that's a no-no. You wouldn't know that in the book. It says we encourage this. It could be an incredible thing, an experience for you to learn more about. Do you know what's in this? And it's a book. I mean, this is the sixth step. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, right? So you don't mind if I talk about what's in the book rather than what you hear about every day when you go to the meetings. Now, this is what the sixth step is all about. By doing this and getting rid of these obstacles so you can get closer to him, get ready to do the seventh step, and then move on. You know, and become free. You know, see the relationship with him is right. And great events will come. Have great events. Remarkable things happen to you. You know, sincerely take this. You know, remarkable things. So thank you very much. God bless you. Okay.